This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Love, Loss, and What We Ate, a memoir by Padma Lakshmi. This is the author. For Teddy. The heart knows no pain sharper than love's arrow. Chapter 1. It was the end of summer and the end of a life as I had lived it. The year was 2007. Inside the Surrey Hotel, which I would come to call the Sorry Hotel, then a musty residential place, much like the Chelsea Hotel, but without the artists. I sat on the floor with cardboard boxes towering all around me. These walls and floors, cloaked in dusty beige and brown, with a linoleum and formica-laden kitchenette, would be my refuge, a place where the displaced, like me, put themselves. 1 month earlier, I had finished moving out of my beautiful home, taking the last pictures off the walls, wrapping the last trinkets in tissue, and finally, nauseatingly, separating the wedding photos into two neat piles. Everything I had been carting from one stage of my life to another to remind me of me was in the boxes that surrounded me. And there were so many of them now, just days before my 37th birthday. But so little of me left. At the end of a marriage, no one wins. There's only anger, sorrow, guilt, emptiness, and defeat. Outside it rained. There had been many rainy nights that summer. I had been sitting, staring at nothing, for so long that my tailbone had started to throb. Far off, the muffled sound of a phone ringing and ringing finally penetrated my daze. As I rose to silence the phone, shifting my weight, I felt the sharp, sudden pull of surgical stitches on my abdomen. I reached out to steady myself against a box. As I did, it shifted. I heard the silky, scratchy rustle of cellophane against cardboard. Down tumbled dozens of dusty kumquats from a bag that had been perched precariously on the top of the stack. They were a gift from my worried mother, shipped from her garden in Los Angeles. When the avalanche stopped, my gaze focused on the bright, beautiful fruit, the orbs glowing orange against the dull backdrop of everything else. The man I had left was like that. He could illuminate any room, no matter how dim. My future husband and I had met 8 years earlier, in 1999, in the shadow of the Statue of Liberty. After my European modeling career had more or less come to a close in the late 90s, I embarked on a professional acting career in Italy. Starting in 1997, I also began to co-host an Italian television show called Domenica Inn. I was surprisingly busy with work, and after acting in two period miniseries in 1998, decided to build on what I hoped was a burgeoning career by moving back to L.A., where I had lived as a teenager. I came to New York frequently, too, as most of my friends and extended family lived there. I was finding my way again in the U.S. after spending most of my 20s in Europe. For the first time since college, I was single. I dated some, but not seriously. Instead, I focused on auditions and on writing and then promoting my first cookbook, Easy Exotic. For my first role, I had to gain 20 pounds, which was a cinch and a pleasure. Best 3 months of my life, actually. Losing the weight after filming ended? Not so much. I wanted to do it in a healthy way. The regimen I came up with was not quite a diet. There was no deprivation involved, mainly because deprivation is miserable. The more brutal or austere the diet, the harder it is to keep. Instead, I tweaked recipes for my favorite foods from around the world in an attempt to excise calories but not flavor. And those recipes became Easy Exotic. I landed a publishing contract for the book, largely because, well, everyone wants to know what a model eats. Tina Brown, ex-Vanity Fair and New Yorker editor, had recently founded a new magazine, Talk, as well as a publishing imprint, Talk Books, in conjunction with Miramax Books. My book, left over from the previous Miramax list, was one of her first books. I doubt my silly little cookbook, closer to pamphlet than proper volume, was her first choice. But somehow, I was invited to the new magazine's launch party, a Great Gatsbyan affair on Liberty Island. It's still the best party I have ever been to, except, of course, for my own wedding. But that wouldn't come until 5 years later. On a balmy, beautiful August night, I came with a few friends, including my book editor, who would eventually become one of my bridesmaids. We all boarded the ferry and arrived at a fete lit by candles. Tina had invited such a strange and wonderful mix of people, a combination of the high-minded and the pop, a particularly glamorous herd of heads of state, cultural tastemakers, movie stars, artists, models, writers, and other starstruck dilettantes like myself. After all, this was the woman who, as editor-in-chief of The New Yorker, had devoted, to jeers as well as applause, an entire issue to fashion, starring writers like John Updike. She employed similar juxtapositions on the pages of Vanity Fair, too, and it had served both the magazine and her reputation very well. It was what Tina was good at. She brought really interesting people from the far ends of the cultural spectrum together. She enjoyed it, and she had the power to do it. It is a very important lesson in good hosting and curating that I still use today. This time, that room just happened to be all of Liberty Island. I found myself in an electric turquoise calypso slip dress, so 90s, laughing and dancing with the likes of Henry Kissinger, Todd Solondz, and Madonna, excited about my first book and my new life back in America. Colorful fireworks lit the sky. There was certainly magic at work that night. Typically, parties are the perfect setting for the spectator sport we know as people watching. But, whether intentionally or not, this party was so dimly lit you couldn't quite see who the other guests were. There were low-wattage fairy lights strung about, the kind you put up at Christmas, powered by generators, but that was it. If you wanted to really experience the party and its luminaries, you had to dive in and walk around. Get up close and personal. I found myself passing a very fair-skinned Indian man who looked familiar. We both turned somehow just in time as our eyes met. As we talked, I developed a hunch that this twinkly-eyed man with his arched eyebrows, salt-and-pepper beard, bald pate, and sharp nose might be Salman Rushdie. I was a teenager when the trouble had started, but even then I'd seen the images. I imagine most Indians had, of the man, our own Hemingway, whose life was under threat for his book, The Satanic Verses, and its supposed affront to Islam. His eminence was compounded by the controversy. But this man couldn't be him. He seemed to know all about me. He asked me about my life in Italy, my childhood in Madras. I decided he was probably some distant uncle. At some point, he gave me what even a naive like me recognized as a pickup line. "I've always been interested in Indian diaspora stories," he said, or something like that. "Perhaps we could talk about yours." "I was game," I told him. We exchanged numbers. "Can you write your full name?" I asked, which must have seemed odd, but he said nothing and did. "Aha," I thought as I read the scrawl. "It is him." I wasn't thinking very clearly. I was a couple champagnes in, but at least I'd have his autograph. This is how removed from my life this man really was. The next morning, I was in Nolita, contemplating a Tracy Fife mustard yellow scarf dress. Again, so 90s. When I got a call from a man with an Anglo-Indian accent. "Oh, sorry, wrong number," the man said, and hung up. How strange, I thought, as I bent over with the dress still half over my head in the tiny fitting room. I call back the number that now appeared on my nifty new cellular telephone. "Salman, is that you? Are you crank calling me?" "Well, yes, I think I just dialed the wrong number. But it didn't sound like you. What are you doing?" he asked, uncharacteristically fumbling for words. "Trying on a dress. I think I like it." "You should buy it," he said. And I did. And so our telephonic relationship began. At first, I thought it strange that someone as important and, I assumed, busy as he must be, had time to talk as often as we did. Little did I know that writers are incredibly gifted at finding ways not to write. I soon solved the mystery of how he'd known about my life. Several months prior, in the course of promoting his latest novel, he had been featured in the Italian magazine Panorama. Inside, there was a small profile of me. He'd read it and saved it. I'd just gotten my first American cell phone a month before, and the novelty of being able to take him anywhere with me, the Santa Monica Pier or the farmer's market in West Hollywood, brought an intimacy to our calls. And a thrill, too. I described the world to him as I experienced it. I felt like a Bond girl with that phone pressed to my ear and that charming Anglo accent on the line. Years later, I would see that film, Her by Spike Jonze, and identify with the main character's mounting feelings about a computer OS that he becomes emotionally attached to. What would my friends think of me, having this telephonic relationship with a married author, almost a quarter of a century older than me, and living in England with special branch security protection? The whole thing seemed surreal. It's hard to explain now, but I fell in love with Salman over the phone. I was still in my 20s, and no one of his artistic or intellectual caliber had ever so much as crossed my path. He had such a mellifluous voice, calm and mysterious. It gained an impish lilt just when he was telling you some juicy punchline. He had a wicked sense of humor, and he seduced with his greatest weapon, his words. He knew how to construct the perfect compliments, too, layered with acute observations about me that, quite frankly, seemed unimaginable coming from someone who'd just been in my actual presence for mere minutes. He told me stories of his own childhood in Bombay, his early years in London, too. He confided in me and seemed interested in the most mundane and microscopic details of my new lonely life in L.A. He listened to stories of my childhood with great patience. He understood, I felt, what it was like to be Indian in the West. And he understood the awkwardness and melancholy we all felt when going back home to India, too. For the next 3 weeks, we spoke probably about two or three times every day. In the soul-sucking intellectual desert that was L.A. for me at the time, I was starving for that kind of connection. And my future husband's phone calls were a 9-course meal airlifted in with iced champagne to boot. I have to admit, his attention, almost more than his charm, probably seduced me. Despite my small potatoes cookbook deal and the occasional invite to a glitzy party, I wasn't exactly flying high in L.A. I had left a life of glamour and a dram of success as a model, and more recently as an actress in Italy, to return to the city of my adolescence. As a foreigner, I felt there was an implied limit to my career in Italy, where I would always just be, I don't know, a curiosity. I wanted to try my hand in America before it was too late. I wanted to make the transition to more stimulating work before modeling decided it had had enough of me. Worse still, I was turning 30 in a little over a year, a milestone that in the business of appearance might as well be a gravestone. That was the backdrop when he started calling. During a time when no one seemed interested in me in Los Angeles, a man came along who was, and not just any man. Once he called as I stood at the sink eating a peach, the juice streaking down my arm. I picked up. "Hi, Salman," I said. "Hold on for a second. I'm eating a peach." "What color is it?" he asked. Could I really be so inconsequential if Salman Rushdie wanted to know the color of my peach? It sounds silly in retrospect, I know, but at the time, in the midst of a crisis of self-worth, I eagerly took up the fantastical notion that I had actually begun to inspire this great man. Salman lived in London at the time, but he rented a place on Long Island every summer. He liked being in New York, where even during the fatwa, he felt safe enough to enjoy the city without his typical security detail. After a few weeks, I was set to come to New York to make my first appearance on the Food Network to promote Easy Exotic. He told me he soon was returning to the city, too, for work, and asked if I'd like to have lunch. He told me he was married sometime in the first week by saying he was here in the States with his family, nothing more. I knew damn well what he meant, even though he had said it in the blandest way possible. But I didn't stop speaking to him, because I was incapable of giving up this new, exhilarating presence in my life. Up to that point, our connection had been only verbal, only telephonic. So it was easy to justify how I could keep speaking to him. Nonetheless, I didn't want to be that woman. I convinced myself that ours was a platonic relationship. Since no hanky-panky had gone on, I could continue my friendship with this man. I was powerless to refuse any contact from him whatsoever. I can't go with you to lunch, I said. It's just lunch. Touché. I proposed a stroll instead. It seemed simpler, more innocent, less fraught with potential for misunderstanding, less like a date. A walk, a stroll, could end at any time for any reason I could conjure up if needed. We were to meet at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on the steps of the Metropolitan Museum. Years later, he would use the same scene in a book dedicated to me. He sat there waiting as I got out of the yellow cab in my mustard yellow dress. He wore his slightly rumpled look, a faded black t-shirt, baggy slacks, and a loose blue cotton jacket. We walked in Central Park, around and around the lake. The weather was perfectly sunny, yet it was still pleasant. It was one of those rare, late summer afternoons when it's warm but not too hot. Sunlight streamed through swaying maple leaves. Families were trying to squeeze out the last drop of summer, picnicking on the grass. Teenagers were playing frisbee. We heard snatches of music from street performers as we circled the lake. We smelled the occasional whiff of pot smoke. I was high on something else. We enjoyed Mr. Softy Cones and lingered until the lake glowed, until the sun sank behind the trees. I can't remember what we talked about, except that we never stopped talking. I suppose we spoke of everything and nothing, just happy to be speaking now while standing, finally, on the same ground together. I lost track of time, but knew some hours had passed. It was getting dark. He was staying nearby at the Mark Hotel. I said I'd walk him there. Because neither of us wanted the day to end, we decided to have a drink at the hotel bar. In an attempt to be cool, I ordered a single malt scotch on the rocks. I was so nervous that I drained my glass. I had dinner plans with friends nearby, so he walked me to the restaurant. Not thinking what it might imply, I invited him to come along and sit down with us. I just couldn't bear to say goodbye to him. We fell into bed that night. At 3 a.m., I woke with a start. I'm naked in a married man's bed. I got dressed and skulked out of the Mark, feeling like a hussy. Once home, I showered, attempting to scrub away my shame. There were so many reasons we shouldn't be together. He was married, for one, with a young son. He lived in London. The ominous cloud of the fatwa hung over his head. He was 23 years my senior, old enough to be my father. I consoled myself by resolving that there was only one decision to make. The next step was too obvious to doubt. We would stop speaking. I would go back to my life and he to his. But he kept calling. And I kept answering. I couldn't resist him. Speaking to his disembodied voice allowed me to convince myself that we were still two innocents. Our courtship already felt like a dream. His face had lit up television screens in India and around the world. Even before the trouble with Iran, he was considered a formidable writer and a great intellectual mind. Up close, I had only known the weighty world of lingerie modeling. His gravitas was the spark that lit my attraction. He was everything I wasn't. He was a lot of what I wanted to be. He didn't try to fit in. I had spent my career trying to be what other people wanted me to be, to embody whatever quality they felt was needed to sell jeans or bras or perfume. He had made a life of being different. I was totally taken by this man. And my admiration for him propelled me ever toward him. The fire burned because of his wit and charm and the connection between us. But I had to admit, if only to myself, that this was not innocent. That now I had no platonic alibi to hide behind. In him I had found a fellow wanderer, someone who knew what it was like to always feel slightly displaced. In my case, I had spent years shuttling between India and the U.S., then later throughout Europe. He, too, was an Indian raised in the West. He understood my experience firsthand. In L.A., I spend much of my time milling around commercial sets with teenagers. Many models don't finish high school. The girls were sweet, the conversation less than stimulating. I was intellectually curious, and I wanted to be stimulated and challenged. I loved books. The important mentors in my life had valued learning. There was Mr. Henninger, my high school English teacher and academic Olympiad coach, who threw end-of-the-year parties where you had to come dressed as a literary character. He came as Godot, a sign on his chest reading, "I'm here." There was Michael Spingler, my French professor from college and later when I was starving as a model in Paris, a savior who invited me into his home to share pots of beans and lardons with his friends, bookstore owners, poets, and authors. There was my grandfather, a hydro engineer who retired only to get a law degree and become a practicing attorney, only to retire once more to become a tutor to college students studying math and science as well as the humanities. I was primed to value what Salman had to offer of himself, and it fed me so completely that I was blinded to everything else. Salman wanted to see me once more that week before I went back to L.A. Again, he asked me to lunch, and again, I should have said no. This time, however, lunch seemed like the best option. Meeting in a public place meant we couldn't even hold hands. We met at Balthazar, the old-world Soho brasserie, which in the late 90s was all the rage. Propriety be damned. My 29th birthday was approaching, and he handed me a copy of his latest book, The Ground Beneath Her Feet. On the title page, he had crossed out her and written your, and signed it, Love, Salman. As if this weren't enough, he asked me what I would like as a present. As long as it wasn't a Maserati, he'd be happy to oblige, he said. I'd known him then for less than 30 days. I searched my mind for something appropriate. It couldn't scream mistress, and I couldn't exactly ask Salman Rushdie for a CD player. And so I asked for a story. Sure, he said. He could easily dig up an unpublished piece in a drawer somewhere. No, I said, an original story. Something you write for me. The story synopsis that he wrote for Random House and faxed to me would eventually become The Enchantress of Florence, his 9th novel, finally published a year after our divorce. Just 3 weeks had gone by since I'd first met him fleetingly on Liberty Island. Indeed, we had only been in each other's actual presence 3 times. Yet I could no longer imagine a life without this man in it. I didn't know what had hit me. It was like living in a landlocked place all your life, and then one day, seeing the ocean for the first time, and swimming in it. I had opened a door I didn't know existed. My heart leapt every time the phone rang, and my heart began to sink every time a few hours went by and it didn't ring. Salman was a great talker. He could speak knowledgeably about anything. 1 minute enlightening you on an obscure Eastern European author, then in the next moment speaking with fluency on Mexican music. He could use baseball stats to drive home a point about history. Even when I went out with friends in Los Angeles, or feigned interest in the dates I was still going on, what elaborate lengths we go to fool ourselves. The best part of the evening would be coming home and telling him all about it, just as he woke up in London. He could be erudite and serious, but he could also be funny, sardonic. And he was an equal opportunity derider, poking fun at everything, from poetry to pop culture. He often joked about poets, oh, their words don't even go to the end of the page. I felt lofty by association, which buoyed my shaky confidence. I had achieved some measure of success in my industry in Europe, yes, but I was one of the only people in my family without a graduate degree. I had always felt conflicted about my work, at once proud of how far I had come and eager to prove that I had more to offer than a nice silhouette. I saw in him, even if I didn't admit it to myself at the time, the pathway to a life full of learning and growing. Our relationship continued over the phone for several more weeks, and I continued my life in L.A. as if nothing had changed. Only a year had passed since I'd moved back to the States after spending most of my 20s in Europe. My theater degree and a lack of any real job experience hung around my neck like a yoke. Sure, I had done 2 films in Italy, but I was hustling to even find an agent willing to take me on in L.A. The book had done modestly well, and I soon got word that it had won the 1999 Versailles World Cookbook Fair Award for Best First Cookbook. They sent me a scrolled-up certificate with a very official gold seal on it. But no one knew or cared, except my mother and maybe my editor. My advance had long since been spent, and it would be ages before I earned it out and saw any checks from book sales. It had been a few months since I'd published the book, and after the promotional tour, I returned to the slog of commercial castings and the loneliness of California, the isolation chamber of my mom's 86 Nissan Stanza. This was the same car I had learned to drive in at 16. Regardless of all I had seen and done in college and abroad in Milan and Paris as a model, as an actress or TV host, I suddenly didn't feel like I had come very far from those high school days at all. L.A. would have this effect on me until years and years later. That November, Salman's latest novel was to be published in French, and he would be going to Paris to celebrate. "Come with me," he said. "I'll send you a ticket." I had to say yes. Yes to Paris, to an escape from L.A., and yes to him. I couldn't refuse the adventure. I'll admit I applied very little rational thought to the decision to go. I didn't think of what accepting the invitation might mean. People are so strange, aren't we? This man invited me to Paris. We'd spent so many nights burying our souls on the phone. We'd slept together once, months ago, but still. And yet I insisted that we stay in separate hotel rooms. God forbid a rendezvous in the city of love with a married man have a whiff of impropriety. The trip lasted about 4 days and immediately introduced me to the realities of the fatwa. When I arrived at the hotel, Salman and I managed a brief hello before I was introduced to the officers assigned by the French government to his protection. The head of security in Paris was a stocky black man with a shaved head, who looked stern and terrifying until he smiled. He was a teddy bear, and comforted me with his warm presence. "Je suis le Cojac Nègre," he told me when I asked his name, flashing that disarming grin, "and a lollipop. Just call me the Black Cojac." There was an official dinner hosted by the English ambassador and a reading of Salman's work by the French actress Marie-France Pizier. I met Salman's publisher, Ivan Nabokov, Vladimir's grandson. We even went to visit my old professor and mentor, Michael Spingler, who still lived in the same apartment on Rue de Alésia, where I had spent so many happy evenings with his family. Throughout the trip, my separate hotel room stayed empty, except for my bags, my bedsheets unrumpled. But I suppose it was good to have it there, in case the spell was broken somehow, now that we were actually in each other's physical presence for more than a few hours at a time. Or perhaps what if his wife suddenly showed up? I was aware that I was involved in something indecent. Otherwise, why would I have asked for the room in the first place? I had become one of those women you read about and cannot imagine being. My morality and sense of right were eroded by the allure of this man's ardor and attention. That I could burn one day for the sin of choosing adventure over decency did not deter me from running toward that adventure. I can't remember a distinct moment when I made the decision to offer myself to this married man. A thing that, until it happened, would have been unthinkable to me. I suppose drowning my inhibitions in scotch at the Mark Hotel in August had allowed me to break the glass of propriety. But now there was little will left in me to put a halt to things, to say no to the best thing that had ever happened to me. I still thought we'd soon go back to our separate and very different lives. But for those 4 days, I wanted to savor every second of my unexpected and fantastical jaunt. An adulterous Cinderella, not wanting the clock to strike 12. That December, I went back to India, as I almost always do over Christmas. At my grandmother's house, between meals and temple visits, I gave myself a crash course in Rushdie. I couldn't get enough. I read The Moor's Last Sigh, set in Kerala, my family's ancestral home. Midnight's Children, a story of India's independence told through a writer who was involved with a cook named Padma, and another girl later known as Parvati, my middle name. Coincidence? Shame, and The Ground Beneath Her Feet. I had read some of the satanic verses when I was young and tried again. Every time he'd call, I'd recount what I'd just finished reading. It was great fun being able to ask the author to clarify or expand on any given page, on any given day. I began to fall in love with his writing, too. Due in part to his presence in my life, I had begun to grow as a person. I spent the night of the millennial New Year at an orphanage in Chennai, also known to me as Madras, cooking for the children there and playing until we fell asleep before midnight. I suppose I had to find a way to cleanse my soul as well. On one of the first few times we spoke in the New Year, Salman had an announcement. By phone, he reported that he had asked his wife for a divorce. As hard as it might be to believe, this development was a shock to me. I don't know what I expected from our relationship, but I had not expected that. At least not this soon, I think. We'd never discussed our future. We'd never discussed the idea of his divorcing his wife. My reaction was a fully emulsified mixture of shock and guilt. I didn't want to be responsible for breaking up a little boy's family. I didn't get it. We'd spent a total of less than 2 weeks together, if you added up New York, Paris, and a trip he made that winter to L.A. And he was leaving his wife? I insisted he not divorce his wife on my account. He assured me again and again that the marriage had been over before we met. He said they slept in separate beds. We decided to keep things between us as they were, to not make any sudden moves. But my intentions and worries proved no match for my affection. I still scurried to the phone when I thought a call was from him. I was young, starstruck, and love-struck. And after a few months, we started making plans. I spent time traveling to and from L.A., and Salman went to his usual award ceremonies, symposiums, readings, and the like. I often came along. I joined him in Amsterdam for the Boekenbal, the ball that launched Dutch Book Week, when he was the first foreigner they ever honored. I still look at the photos of that ball to remember the couple we once made. He in his tux and gray beard, which still had a streak of black near the chin. Me in a sleeveless red Alaya gown and little diamond earrings, which I had bought years before during my early modeling days, my first ever extravagant purchase. $700, my mother had yelped when I told her. We looked so in love. Few people could spend time with us without feeling our charge. I was eager to leave L.A. and had wanted to move back to New York. He, too, loved the city, and so it was decided. We moved in together in the spring of 2000. We rented a gorgeous brownstone on the Upper West Side with four floors, including a grand dining room dominated by an ornately carved wooden fireplace. The dining room had a little bay window that looked onto the back garden. We sublet this place for 6 months. This was the house in which my husband would write Fury. Our landlords lived upstate on a farm that supplied many of the city's finest restaurants. Every now and then, they'd send us a crate of vegetables, leeks and zucchini, carrots and tomatoes. I remember making a lot of ratatouille that summer. My American TV career began to take off. In the course of my book tour for Easy Exotic, I'd appeared on the Food Network a couple of times, and that had led to a development deal the following spring, just as soon as we had moved in together. I would join Melting Pot, a series that aired every day at the same hour, each episode featuring a different pair of tag-team chefs representing a different world cuisine. There was Team Latino with Aaron Sanchez and Alex Garcia. There was Team Mediterranean with Rocco Dispirito and Michelle Bernstein. Michael Simon and another chef had the midweek Eastern European slot. There was Caribbean cooking and soul food from the South. And then, on Fridays, there was me. Team, well, International Brown, I guess. The show was called Padma's Passport. Oddly, I had no co-host. And of course, I wasn't a chef, but a home cook. It was the first time, but far from the last, that I would feel completely out of my depth in the food world. Meanwhile, I still occasionally auditioned for parts in L.A. and New York. I played a bitchy, talentless pop singer named Silk in Mariah Carey's Glitter. I played a kidnapped princess on Star Trek Enterprise. Nothing groundbreaking, but I was having fun and happy to be working. The next few years were, for the most part, blissful. I was in love. I soon was living in a beautiful house, which Salman bought and which I renovated. I trawled Simon's Hardware for knobs and handles and hired contractors and architects. We restored the brownstone from four apartments to its original glory as a Gilded Age single-family home. When we were together in New York, even before we moved out of our sublet, we had our daily routine. Salman typically woke before I did. He'd make me green tea with honey and buttered toast and set it very sweetly on my bedside table. I'd go to the gym, shower, then go to auditions or jobs or sit at a stool in the kitchen with my laptop, cooking and reading in preparation for my show. I overthought that process, researching cardamom and rehearsing the dozens of facts I'd learned so I would be armed with enough things to say on camera. I was learning on the job, and until then, I only had my experience on Italian television to go by. I do my own work until I knew Salman's daily writing session was almost over. Then I'd bound up the stairs to the third floor, where his office was, all the while thrilled that I lived in New York City, in a house with a staircase. I'd poke my head into his office and find his lap. Occasionally, he'd show me drafts of his work, an article for The New Yorker or an op-ed for The Guardian in England, and I'd pore over each one, trying to impress him with my thoughtful feedback. He ultimately made it clear that anything but my gushing approval would be ignored. But I didn't mind. He was the writer after all, right? One summer, we were walking together in the middle of Central Park when it suddenly started to rain. The clouds spilled sheets of water on us, and we took shelter under a tree. I was tugging at his arm, trying to pull him back out into the downpour, because after growing up on Bollywood rain sequences, the notion seemed kind of romantic to me. He wouldn't budge, muttering on about not wanting to turn his clothes into a soppy mess. I just laughed then. You know, when you're in love, such differences of opinion seem beguiling. At my most ardent, I had sought to please and charm him by preparing his favorite foods, decorating our home, trying to look my best, and telling him funny stories that I had rehearsed in my head on my way home to him. We had countless dinner parties for our friends, and I tried to create evenings that would please everyone, but particularly him. I loved hearing him hold forth from the head of the table, telling his layered stories as I flitted in and out of our kitchen barefoot. My feet throbbed as we lay in bed, satiated after those long evenings, reliving what funny things everyone had said and done as we fell asleep in each other's arms. We had our own patois, a jumble of East and West, a language of love and humor for comparing notes on the world. Early on, I was both entranced and a bit terror-stricken by his friends. I didn't realize that authors, like basketball players, hung out together. His friends were literary giants like Susan Sontag, Peter Carey, and Don DeLillo. Dropped in the middle of these people, I was unsure of myself and daunted by what he had said about them. I loved talking about books, but I was in constant fear that my English lit class knowledge would extinguish itself mid-sentence. And so I would sometimes retreat to the kitchen, where I could relish our guests and their stories from a safe distance. At the table, among others, were Don and his wife, Paul Auster and his second wife, Siri Husvedt, herself an accomplished writer, their daughter Sophie, barely a teenager, and Susan Sontag. My insecurity at meeting Salman's friends revealed itself mostly in my cooking. My strategy for overcoming my feelings of inferiority was to keep my hands busy, to cook and bring drinks and clear plates. For our first dinner party in our Upper West Side sublet, I planned a simple Indian meal. Our food is more regional than most Westerners realize, and I wanted to show the nuances of flavor from both my South Indian roots and Salman's Northern Kashmiri ancestry. I had perused a cookbook written years ago by Salman's sister, and noted that as kids they'd loved chicken. Their father would complain about how much Salman and his sisters wanted to eat it all the time. The first four recipes in her book all had yogurt in them. It was common for North Indian and especially Kashmiri dishes to have yogurt or cream, so I made a creamy chicken curry with mint from Easy Exotic, named after my uncle Chidambaram. The recipe called for a healthy dose of fiery dried red chilies, as well as garam masala, a North Indian spice blend of freshly dry-roasted and ground spices, such as cinnamon, coriander seed, cardamom, and cumin. I wanted Salman to feel not just at home, but like he was back home, where we were from. It was how he made me feel. I could not be his first wife, or his second, or third, for that matter. Indeed, because of our age difference, I couldn't experience many of his firsts with him. But I could, with my cooking, take him back home, to a sweet, idyllic place and time, back to those smells of childhood in India. I wanted him to feel that with me, he was finally home. I found a heavy cast iron pan, heaved it up onto the stove, and began to roast the whole spices and chilies together. I tossed around the coriander seeds and cinnamon twigs, scraping the pan with my metal spatula as I raked them back and forth. My eyes began to burn and tear as the spices released their oils. The aroma of those spices, I hoped, would be carried upstairs to his workroom, where he sat writing. I ground them up in an old Vitamix and wondered if our landlords would ever get the smell out of the machine. I doubted the sweet patrician kitchen with eyelet curtains and Betty Crocker decor had ever been assaulted with such smells. I made a mental note to soak the inside of the flask with lemon juice. I made white beans with tomato and amchur, or dried green mango powder. The plump, round pink tomatoes here in the U.S. tasted bland and watery to me most of the year. I took to adding a pinch of palm sugar and green mango powder to duplicate the sweet and sour notes in the less good-looking but delicious tomatoes from back home. I used a whole stick of butter to fry the ginger and red onions in the wok before adding the rest of the ingredients. There was a street food stew we ate with fluffy white bread buns as children called pav bhaji. I remembered having it first in Pune when I went to visit my Aunt Neela, shortly after her marriage. There would be a semicircle of scooters and motorcycles gathered around a man with a huge black iron griddle about 3 feet across. Here the various vegetables would be bubbling away with tomato and ginger, a ton of not ghee or clarified butter, but amul butter. Whole bricks would be buried in the hot stew, which got darker and darker as the night set in. The tangy mix of ginger and dried mango powder, fat, and spices bathed the soft, buttery white beans in just enough heat. I made delicate lemon rice, common in our southern state of Tamil Nadu. Mustard seeds and curry leaves, sent from my mother's garden in Los Angeles. Fresh serrano chilies and white gram lentils were fried in hot oil with turmeric and cashews. That hot oil was then mixed into the rice with fresh lemon juice and kosher salt. The bright yellow color would look stunning at the table. And to cool things off, I made raita, a yogurt and cucumber relish. I kept my hands a little too busy. I cooked 3 times the amount I should have. We didn't even have the room in the fridge for the leftover lemon rice and raita, the curried chicken with cream, or the white beans. But luckily, everyone seemed to enjoy the meal. Beautiful young Sophie proclaimed that she liked the spread and she would be happy to take much of it home, which a few of our guests did. It helped, too, that I cooked. Who doesn't like the cook? My favorite among the guests was Don. I often found myself at dinner parties and Thanksgivings, sitting with him. He spoke to me as he always seemed to, softly and with great care. The opposite of pretentious. He spoke about his work, if at all, as a plumber might about installing pipes. Generously, he treated me like a peer. My favorites aside, I appreciated them all for their kindness toward me. If they were judging me, they never let on. For all of Salman's warnings that there was good Susan and bad Susan, Miss Sontag was always a pussycat to me. My relationship was an all-glamour and high-minded discussion, of course, and thank goodness. Early on, acquaintances would ask me breathlessly, "So does he just walk around being brilliant all the time?" "Yes," I'd say. "I keep a notebook on me at all times to record every single word." "Wow. What did he say last night?" "He told me to stop hogging the sheets." Chapter 2. By 2001, I had begun writing for magazines, first Vogue, then a style column in Harper's Bazaar, and a regular stint on food and fashion at the New York Times Syndicate. I was still doing occasional modeling jobs here and there, but I began to enjoy the writing much more. That is to say, I enjoyed having written, once the piece was done. I still had serious insecurities as a writer, which being published did nothing to assuage. I was lucky in that Glenda Bailey of Harper's and Gloria Anderson at the Times pretty much left me to write about whatever interested me. I began by doing a piece for Anna Wintour on the scar on my arm, but I was terrified of writing it. Here, my future husband was extremely supportive and edited the piece before it went to Vogue. Having him upstairs in his office while I was down in the basement writing was daunting. But if I really got in a jam, it was also helpful. Except that he knew little about fashion and had little patience for being interrupted. But he damn well did know how to write. The series on the Food Network did not get renewed after the first season. I did land a gig hosting a couple of documentaries called Planet Food for the network and for Discovery International. A sort of light precursor to Anthony Bourdain's No Reservations, but with better hair. It involved my traveling to a country and getting to know its people through their food. These were hard shoots, but I was totally in my element. I loved nothing more than spelunking around a place and tasting my way through it. I had done as much throughout my modeling career anyway. All those years of traveling to shoot French bras in Bali and Scottish sweaters in the Seychelles led me to taste and experience the world in a way I would never have been able to do otherwise. Because I started modeling later than most, after my bachelor's degree, I was able to appreciate it more. At the end of those many trips, my suitcase was jam-packed with strange spices and sauces and seeds and twigs. I would use these in my own kitchen back in Milan, Paris, or New York to try and recreate what I had tasted in those various corners of the planet. Coming from India and spending what seemed like most of my upbringing in the kitchens of my grandmother, mother, and various aunts, the kitchen was where all the action was after all anyway, I valued and took a keen interest in spices. Living and cooking in Europe during my 20s taught me for the first time about French technique. And the modeling jaunts afforded me the possibility to learn how people ate in other parts of the world. But I was just a good cook, with a bottomless curiosity about food. I'd never in my life entertained the idea of a career in the culinary arts in any form until the Food Network thought I was capable of one. I still wasn't sure they were right. I would have never even thought of publishing that first cookbook, but my publisher, who suggested the idea, thought there was a marketing hook, banking on our culture's curiosity about models and their diets. The acting was slow going. My degree in theater mattered little. I would audition for parts in films and TV while still writing and modeling. I'd get a few bites, or at least callbacks. Often I heard that they liked me, but just, quote, weren't going ethnic with this role. When it finally came out, Glitter was panned. The transition out of modeling and into a new career was very haphazard, and a gradual one. I had to look hard at where my professional life was going, and decide to be open to whatever work there was. My modeling career had been born of financial necessity, and then pursued because I had become easily accustomed to the lifestyle, and of course, the money. I had been able to pay off my college loans before many of my peers even settled into their first jobs or careers. But I felt some measure of self-loathing and deep insecurity for being in a profession that didn't engage my mind, that seemed to be due to no accomplishment of my own, but rather to the alchemy of the genes endowed to me by my parents. I wasn't feeling guilty or bothered enough, however, to do something about it until the flow of work slowed down. My schedule also made it easy for me to travel around the globe with Salman for awards, literary festivals, and red carpets, but it was unpredictable, and work came in waves. It was hard to plan dinners with friends and then have to cancel them at the last minute because some shoot or modeling job came up. And bookers at modeling agencies don't eagerly continue to push for work for capricious girls with catalog and lucrative ad clients. I was luckier than many of my colleagues making that same transition, because at least I had this roof over my head, and a beautiful roof. Still, I was anxious to make something of myself beyond modeling and prove my worth to my family back in India. I knew they were happy for me. My modeling had brought me much financial success, and it also brought me home to them in India more often. But I'm not sure I would call what they felt about my work pride. The thing that gave me the most satisfaction was cooking. In my kitchen, I felt happy. I felt confident. Eventually, I got around to signing another contract with my publisher, who had been asking for a second cookbook for quite some time. That was right before my marriage to Salman. I had been tinkering with recipes for a few years, but my other writing always took me away, as did those intermittent auditions. I would stop everything I was doing to study my lines or finish an article on deadline. I also had, of course, to sit home on these occasions instead of accompanying my future husband to the many events he developed an appetite for attending. Salman's movements had been so extremely curtailed and limited by the fatwa and the entailed security issues that now that he was free, or freer, to go about his business, I found he was making up for lost time. Who could blame him? At first it was fun going to all those events. I met so many wonderful people I would have never had the occasion to come across. I was modeling, acting, writing, and now about to embark on getting another book published. I was also trying to develop another show on food. It became difficult to manage it all. When I was cooking, I felt the hours slip by. I was never so happy as when barefoot in the kitchen with my hands sticky and my hair smelling slightly of grease. My schedule was erratic and unpredictable. It was a bummer to stop what I was doing in the kitchen, shower, and go to auditions for a part that I knew I probably wouldn't get. I should have been happy to have the audition. Wasn't it what I wanted? Hadn't I studied for a chance to do precisely this? My acting work was picking up. I had just been cast as Princess Bithya in ABC Television's new version of The Ten Commandments, which meant I would be away for 5 weeks in Morocco filming. Salman grumbled about my being away that long. Coming to visit me in a Muslim country was not a possibility either. Indeed, the producers hired 2 security officers to accompany me 24 hours a day, the whole time I was there. Both of them were named James. I felt embarrassed because I was the only actor who needed this precaution due to my personal life. But you know, I was relieved that the producers were willing to hire me in spite of this additional expense. I still wanted to find a way to combine being in front of the camera with my love of all things culinary. I wanted to do another show about food and culture. I'd loved doing Padma's Passport, but I didn't want to do another how-to show. I took to hosting Planet Food like a duck to water and found I was actually pretty good at it. I had a glorious time doing that show. Being thrown on Italian TV when I was at the tail end of my modeling days as part of Dominica Inn taught me so much about hosting. You had to be quick-witted and ready for anything. You had to gauge the set and your guests and adjust accordingly. The adrenaline rush of having no script and being on live TV suited me well. I learned so much on Dominica Inn that I still use to this day. I wanted to go back to TV as a host and do another show on food. I met an executive at E! Network in L.A. who suggested I meet with her friend in New York at Bravo. I was an avid watcher of their show inside the actor's studio, and I knew they had had great success with a show called Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. So I went up to 30 Rockefeller Center to see Bravo's president, Lauren Zelaznik. She and her vice president, Frances Barrick, listened intently to my pitch. My idea felt a bit narrow and too highbrow for them. They needed something broader, with more mass appeal. But they did want to do something in the food space, and to that end, they were developing a food competition show and wondered if I would be a part of it. Oh yes, I would. I would meet with Andy Cohen and Dave Sirwatka of Bravo and have numerous long conversations with Shauna Minoprio, the show's first executive producer. At first skeptical of the idea of reality television, I tended to watch PBS and the History Channel. I was impressed by how these people wanted to turn food into a serious competition. Shauna referenced the old 70s show MasterChef in England, which I had seen years back and really liked. She spoke passionately about wanting the new show to be a proper professional competition, rather than some feel-good how-to show about who could make the best bundt cake. She loved Julia Child, but had no interest in adding to the pile of imitators already on TV. They had researched the food world and even got Tom Colicchio of Gramercy Tavern fame as head judge and a woman named Gail Simmons of Food & Wine magazine to participate. I was excited to be part of the show. Little did I know that I would spend the next decade with these folks. In the meantime, I was still reading for parts, both here in America and in London. We spent half our time in the UK because of my husband's children. I felt the self-induced pressure of making something out of myself, and I wasn't going to wait for these TV people to get their ducks in a row. I was still writing for magazines, but I could do that anywhere, and it actually helped to be in Europe during the fashion shows. The writing also made me more portable, so it was easier to travel with Salman. I noticed he would get grumpy if my schedule conflicted with his. And lately, I always seemed to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. I found it hard to keep all these balls in the air. Salman and I married in the spring of 2004, and I had hoped that this would bring a sense of calm and additional security to our relationship, that we would settle somehow into a rhythm of work and life. But I was never there enough for him. I was struggling to keep him happy while still pursuing all these things I thought would lead to a life not reliant on modeling lingerie or selling shampoo or on my husband, for that matter. If I got a call back, I was happy, but then I'd have to break it to my husband that I couldn't leave with him on one of his upcoming trips to Austria or Brazil. If I told my agent I couldn't go to the callback, my agent, who'd been really hard to get in the first place, would think I was crazy. By the time Bravo was ready to shoot the food show, I had signed on to do a miniseries for British TV called Sharp's Challenge, with that actor from the Lord of the Rings film trilogy, named Sean Bean. It was a real bodice heaver, a period piece set in India during the British Raj. We were to be on location for several weeks, this time in Jaipur, Rajasthan. And I, of course, was to play the local evil queen. Fantastic, I thought. Now we're getting somewhere. Andy Cohen, the programming head of Bravo at the time, called, and I had to tell the network I couldn't do their food show. On the other hand, I had done two miniseries in the same year. I finally felt like my career was taking shape and taking a permanent turn away from modeling. My culinary ambitions would have to wait. But I watched the first season of Top Chef when it came out, and I thought it had some great elements. For the first time, I heard haute cuisine and fine dining being discussed on TV as they were in real life, analyzed matter-of-factly and without pretense. I was frankly surprised it wasn't too inside baseball for most viewers. But I loved what Bravo and the production company Magical Elves had done. They had made the rarefied world of gourmands and Michelin-starred chefs approachable and understandable to those in the audience who weren't necessarily food lovers, or foodies, as they would come to be called. Then, one day, several months later, I got a call from Andy Cohen again. "Are you free now?" he asked. They were green-lighting the show for a second season. And while the ratings were modestly good, they were going to make changes and put a lot more resources behind it. Top Chef would become the thing most Americans would know me from. I had no idea how long it would last or what it would mean. I had done live television in Italy, and I liked hosting. I had wanted to do some type of work around food. I was still working on my second cookbook, and the show could definitely give that a boost. It seemed like fun. Who wouldn't want to sit around eating delicious food and talking about it all day? My first season we shot in L.A. Luckily, my husband also had to be there for part of it, so he could visit. It was daunting how many hours it took to shoot a